And hello, everyone. Welcome to your end credits radio show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and I am coming to you live from the broadcast booth here at CFRU in the University Center at the University of Guelph. I am doing a live show. A live version of End Credits today, which we usually pre-tape, depending on the guest's availability, sometimes on the weekend, sometimes early in the week, but we're trying something new, or at least I'm trying something new by doing it live. So Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to the first ever live version of End Credits, a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be several new movies. A great many new films came out over the break, and I'm going to talk about six of them today. So we're going to split it into halves. We're going to do Aquaman, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and Bumblebee in the first half, forming, I guess, a sort of superhero super block. Let's put it that way. For the second half, I'm going to talk about Mary Poppins Returns, The Favorite, and Vice. I mean, Mary Poppins was nominated for a SAG Award and for the Golden Globes. So, I mean, maybe that does count as prestige. Certainly Vice and The Favorite do, though they didn't win. Olivia Colman won a Golden Globe for Best Actress, but Christian Bale did win the Golden Globe for Best Actor. So those were accomplished Golden Globe films, I guess. I don't want to get too much into the Golden Globes because that's not why I'm here today, but I will say Bohemian Rhapsody is Best Drama. Like a movie, we're not entirely sure who directed what. A movie that's like kind of controversial because of who was the original director and all the stuff that he's sort of been involved in the last few years. Bryan Singer, who's been accused of some very horrible things and then was actually fired from Bohemian Rhapsody before the film was completed. But because he shot more than 50% of the film, he gets sole credit, which, you know, say what you will, but it does seem bizarre that a film that, you know, we're not entirely sure whom to credit the finished film wins Best Picture. Seems bizarre. Anyway, speaking of bizarre, I want to get into some of the films that came out over the holiday break, and I'm going to start with Aquaman, the tale of the superhero who's probably the most maligned, the most made fun of, and gets the last laugh because his movie has made over $200 million so far, number one at the box office the last 3 weeks, over $1 billion worldwide to date, and still growing, still climbing. It's the January period, so there's not a lot of competition, or at least there won't be for another couple of weeks till Glass comes out. So Aquaman, nobody's laughing anymore, or at least they're laughing with Aquaman, because this is a campy movie. It's a bit corny. It's a bit cornball. But it wears it well. I think the most apt comparison I heard was that it's really kind of like an 80s fantasy kind of film, where it is very much in that spirit of just, you know, big, bold adventure, not so much with, you know, quippy lines and really sharp characterization, but the archetypes are there really, really well. And, of course, there's, you know, sort of 2000s or 2018 production values. The special effects are immaculate. The underwater kingdom of Atlantis and all the various locations are really well rendered, and it is a very, very expensive looking movie, to say the least. But it's also got this synth score at times, which makes it sound very 80s. And I'm not sure if that was intentional or that was just sort of the sound James Wan was going for. But it does feel very intentional that this is reaching backwards to a time where you could do these big, brash sort of quasi-Shakespearean things. And there's a very Shakespearean quality to it because it's about two brothers fighting over a kingdom, and to an extent a woman. But there is that quality to it, something very old-fashioned. It doesn't quite feel like a modern, what we would consider a modern superhero movie. It feels very much more in the mold of like something like Masters of the Universe, but better. Although Dolph Lundgren was in both, so what do you know? So Jason Momoa, this is actually his third time playing Aquaman, which is another oddity in the midst of all this, that, you know, it, we're three movies into Aquaman, and now his story is being told. Jason Momoa, of course, is not maybe the best actor in the world, but what he does have a lot of is he has a lot of charisma, and he has, of course, a great build. He's a good-looking man. So he brings all that in to this character, but there's the same kind of – this kind of I don't know, aloofness, this kind of, like, I just leave me alone. I'm trying to just do my thing. I'm not really in the business of being a superhero, although this takes place after – the events of Justice League. So he's become fairly well known. There's a great scene where he's in a pub having a beer with his father, Aquaman, I mean, and he's approached by some biker looking types who are like, "Are you the Aquaman?" And he's like, "Yeah." And they're like, you think they're about to like rumble, but no, the big burly biker guys get, it's like, "We get a picture with you," which is one of several little like corny moments in the movie. There's also another one later on where we have, Aquaman and Princess Mera, who's played by Amber Heard, they're on this mission to find the ancient trident that will prove Arthur, the Aquaman, is the true king of Atlantis and not his brother Orm, played by Patrick Wilson. But because Mera has lived her entire life under the sea, she's not used to, you know, quote unquote surface living. So there's a scene where like she's getting a taste of that, and quite literally there's a scene of her eating flowers because she doesn't know the difference because she's lived under the sea her whole life, and then Aquaman, instead of like, "No, this is ridiculous, don't eat flowers," he eats the flowers too, which is a cute little moment because of course, if you know the comic book lore, Aquaman and Mera marry, and they become king and queen of Atlantis, although that's not like sort of front of center, which I appreciated. Mera isn't there just to be the love interest. She's very much one of the drivers of the plot and is sort of in her way much more aware of the stakes of what's going on than Aquaman, or at least more invested in the stakes than Aquaman, at least at first. And I think that was a good choice, because I think that as you may have heard with Amy Chopp from The Dragon when we reviewed Justice League, she was very excited to see Mera come to life in the DC movie universe. A lot of people like Mera as a character on her own. She'd become a fairly important character on her own in the comic books. So that was good to see. Patrick Wilson as the extant villain, Ulm, is good. He clearly is kind of relishing the opportunity to play a bad guy, and he's having a lot of fun. And Nicole Kidman, who plays the Aqua Mom, she's the mother of the Aquaman, the Queen of Atlantis. Interesting years for her, because I've been seeing ads for Destroyer, which looks amazing. And it's sort of a transformative role for her. But also, we see her here, you know, with a trident, you know, beating up Atlantean soldiers. And it's quite the spectacle to see Nicole Kidman kicking butt, because it's that's something she hasn't done in a while. One of the things I was also pleased of, that, you know, we have, this was a year for good comic book villains, because there's a connection between Killmonger, the villain in Black Panther, and Orm in Aquaman, and that they're both villains who kind of have understandable grievances, and you can sort of see their point of view, and it is sort of sort of tests your assumptions a bit. I mean, these aren't thinking man pieces. Certainly Aquaman isn't, but there is something to that as well. If there's like I don't know if it's a criticism, but the movie is jam packed. There are like easily like four different villains in this. James Wan threw everything in there. There's the Trench, who are bad guys who could easily be in their own movie. There's Black Manta, who's probably Aquaman's most well-known villain. Could have been his own movie. There's so much going on. I feel like because the DC universe was in such a tenuous position, that James Wan and the makers of the film basically threw the lot in. They threw in everything but the kitchen sink, unsure if maybe this was going to catch on or not. Fortunately for them, the boldness paid off, and I think there's very quickly, we're going to hear about Aquaman 2 in development. And, you know, it's good news for fans of the DC universe. We're definitely getting more Wonder Woman later this year. We're definitely going to get more Aquaman in the future. You know, there are more movies coming. There's the Birds of Prey movie, which stars Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn from Suicide Squad. And of course, there's Shazam coming out later this spring. So the DC Extended Universe is not dead. And I think because of Aquaman, we can be happy for that, because it seems like maybe it's getting its act together. We'll have to wait and see. The other superhero movie, the other like sort of named superhero movie that came out over the break was Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And a lot has been said about this, and not to make this all about the Golden Globes, but Spider-Verse did win the Golden Globe for Best Animated Feature, which effectively broke a long streak, with maybe a couple of exceptions of Disney. Rango comes to mind, but basically Disney owning that category, which is, I don't think should not be understated, because when we were talking about the Library of Congress films that have been preserved in the film registry before the break, all the animated movies in there are Disney movies, and that includes Pixar. Toy Story's in it, and Pixar is a Disney subsidiary now. So for an animated movie to sort of break through like this, to also be a Spider-Man movie too, is really something special, and the film really is something special. The animation style is a mix of 2D and 3D. So it's a mix of old-fashioned cell animation along with what we would call the 3D animation, computer-generated animation. It's really kind of blended like that. It's reminded me somewhat of the Peanuts movie that came out a couple of years ago, in terms of sort of blurring those lines and what belongs to what format. And it's really quite interesting to look at, and I would love to just sort of look at it again and sort of examine it, not necessarily frame by frame, but just to take in the artistry of it now that I've seen it once for the story, and also looking out for all the Easter eggs and Spider-Man fandom bits, which are substantial. There's a lot of for Spider-Man comic book fans, you know, there's characters in here you never thought you would see in a Spider-Man movie, like Tombstone, who is this kind of, I mean, you can imagine he's this gray, ashen-faced, sort of super strong character. He's a henchman for the Kingpin in this. But, you know, you would never think in a million years you would see Tombstone in a Spider-Man movie. The Prowler as well, and the Prowler is key to Miles Morales, who the film is about. Miles Morales is a 15-year-old kid who was created by Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Bagley, I think about, I don't know if it was 10 years ago, or I think it was more like 7 or 8 years ago, but he's a mixed race kid. He's Latino and black. He becomes Spider-Man after the Spider-Man in his universe dies heroically, and has become a very important character in his own right, outside of sort of the spider lore. And the Prowler is key to his background. But the Prowler is this character that goes back to, I think, the 80s or the 90s. This kind of side character who's never a top-tier villain. But here's another one. You would have never thought you would have saw him in a film. The voice cast is really, really great. You have Shameik Moore, who was in this really great film I think I mentioned on the show before, called Dope. If you haven't seen Dope, definitely check it out. It is hilarious and heartfelt and really a lot of fun. So there's Hailee Steinfeld, who we'll be talking about next. She plays Gwen Stacy. And of course, there's a character in the Spider-Man comics called Spider-Gwen, who's basically a female version of Spider-Man. You also have Jake Johnson as sort of the older Spider-Man, because the plot is that there's a crisis where the Kingpin is trying to find his family somewhere in the multiverse, and so he's basically collapsing the multiverse, and all these Spider-Men come together, Spider-Man and Spider-Woman. women, I should say, because we also have, as I said, Haley Steinfeld as Spider-Gwen. There's also Penny Parker, who's sort of the an anime version of Spider-Man. You have Nicolas Cage, which is this really great casting. He plays Spider-Man Noir, which is basically Spider-Man as like a 1930s sort of Raymond Chandler gumshoe detective. And then you also have Spider-Ham. And if you grew up reading comics like I did, Spider-Ham was a pig version of Spider-Man, the original Spider-Pig, if you will. But you would get these comic books that, like, Marvel Comics Presents Tales of Spider-Man or something to this effect, and you'd get a regular run-of-the-mill Spider-Man story. And then in the back, you'd get a 5 or 6 page Spider-Ham story, which is just silly adventures featuring a pig dressed as Spider-Man, a little more cartoonish, a little more kid-friendly than, you know, you might typically think. But, it's just fun. And you would never think in a million years you would go to the movies and see Spider-Ham. But they make it work. It's all these Spider-Men and women come together to fight the Kingpin, to restore balance to the the multiverse. And Liev Schreiber plays the Kingpin, and he's genuinely menacing in it. You may know Vincent D'Onofrio's portrayal of the Kingpin in the Daredevil Netflix series. And I don't think there's been a bad Kingpin yet, because Michael Clark Duncan played Kingpin in the Ben Affleck Daredevil movie, and I thought that was really good. So Kingpin, we seem to be getting Kingpin right, where we're constantly getting Doctor Doom wrong. But yeah, there's just so many great Easter eggs in this, great voice cast. If you're a fan of the comic books, this is an exceptional treat, no question. But I don't think it's inaccessible if you are not a Spider-Man fan, or if you're like a moderate Spider-Man fan. Like, maybe you know Spider-Man from the cartoon, or one of the 60s cartoon, or one of the more modern cartoons, or perhaps even just the Spider-Man movies, or, you know, there's multitudes of engaging with Spider-Man. But there are so many great Easter eggs if you're a fan, including a post-credit scene. Another character I never thought I would see on screen, I'm not going to spoil it, but it also makes fun of sort of some of the Spider-Man memes you see. It's just working on so many levels. It's really incredible to watch. But the thing that sticks out with me too is the artistry. It is a beautiful looking film, and one that pays homage to the comic books. It manages to translate the comic book, the artistry of the comic book, in a way people have kind of tried to do. Ang Lee tried to do it in his Hulk movie, trying to translate the way you read a comic book into sort of a more motion picture medium. And it was, I would say it's somewhat, not successful, but somewhat engaging. But Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse manages to take it to a level that I don't think anyone would have tried before, or at least wouldn't have been as successful at. And I think this is where animation sort of gives you that freedom. You're able to do things in animation that people will forgive or will just go with in a way that they would never go with in live action, which I think is much to the credit of the people behind this movie, recognizing that they could push the boundaries in the way they told the story and in the artistry they brought to it. And I think full credit goes to Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who were sort of the guiding producers of this effort. And, I'll finish up by just adding this little trivia, but Chris Pine plays the Spider-Man that Miles Morales meets at the beginning of the film. So this brings Chris Pine, the last of the Chrises, into the Marvel fold, because Chris Evans, of course, is Captain America, Chris Pine is Star-Lord, and Chris Hemsworth is, of course, Thor. So now Chris Pine, as animated Spider-Man, completes the Chrises. So good work. I think Into the Spider-Verse 1 Spider-Man, so to speak. So let's move on into, before we take a break, this third movie here, Bumblebee, which is not based on the insect, but is based on the Transformer of the same name. I think I think movie audiences, not that I want to speak for all movie audiences, but I think we are weary of the Transformers as realized by Michael Bay, which makes this sort of a shame that we get this movie. Not only that, it comes at the end of a litany of Michael Bay movies where he just basically takes Transformers and makes it a Michael Bay movie. He doesn't recognize anything that's sort of special to the Transformers fans. It's just, I'm making a Michael Bay movie and we're using Transformers to do it. So it comes at the end of all that, but it's also dropped in the middle of this like very busy Christmas season where you had Spider-Verse, where you had Aquaman, and you had Mary Poppins all coming out within the same sort of 10-day period as Bumblebee. And I think that has done Bumblebee a disservice because I won't say it demands to be seen, but I think if you're a Transformers fan, in terms of like the Generation 1 Transformers fans, like going back to the cartoon, it demands to be seen because I think Travis Knight understands this world in a way Michael Bay doesn't want to or can't be bothered with, or is incapable of engaging with this world. So the plot is it takes place in the 80s. It follows Bumblebee, who has come to Earth to set up an Autobot base so that they've basically lost the war on their home world. And he crash lands on Earth, but has a malfunction that he's forgotten himself. He's forgotten his purpose, and he ends up being adopted by a young girl named Charlie, played by Hailee Steinfeld. And I mean, it's almost kind of basically the initial plot, the first act of the first Transformers movie. But it's telling how much of a better director in this regard Travis Knight is. Because he doesn't just use, like, the designs well. I think by the end of Michael Bay's tenure in The Last Knight, the Transformers just basically look like garbage. They didn't look like anything. They all look the same. Travis Knight understands that if a robot becomes a car, or a car becomes a robot, you have to sort of see how that happens. And so Travis Knight, of course, comes from animation. The Book of Life was one of his films, I think, but he's more famous for Kubo and the Two Strings, which is a great film, a stop motion animation. So he knows how to put the moving parts together, as it were. So you actually understand just by, you know, sort of glancing that how Bumblebee becomes a car and how a car becomes Bumblebee, and the two or three other sort of Transformers. This isn't like a Transformers melee like any of those later films, and there's only like a couple of different characters in the film that are the actual Transformers. So there's that portion of it too, but he also does, Travis Knight does a really good job of actually telling a story that has an arc of building relationships between the characters. Some may feel that maybe there's some stuff implied that I'm referring to video essayist Lindsay Ellis, who was maybe reading too much into it. Although, I mean, it's almost easy to understand because there's a scene in it that almost feels like it was taken straight out of The Shape of Water, when Bumblebee is sort of caught in this flooded canal and Hailee Steinfeld's character dives in to save him. But, you know, there's also this, like, really tender scene in the garage where Hailee Steinfeld's character is talking about how her father died and how it made her feel and its effect on her. And the Sam Cooke version of Unchained Melody is playing as she's doing this. And it ends in this, like, very tender hug with her and Bumblebee. And it's very affecting, I have to say. It's, you really believe this girl loves her transforming car, and you believe that it is reciprocated too, that he's very protective of her and he very much wants to be her friend too. And it makes me sad that this is the sixth movie in the series and we finally get here where someone can make a Transformers movie that has a beginning, middle, and end, that isn't all like He-Man action G.I. Joe shoot 'em up barf, and that has actual emotion in it. I think it's telling that a woman wrote this screenplay, because you can feel the difference. It's not like, and then this scene, this blows up, and then this scene, this blows up, and then this scene, we're going to blow up Chicago for the 20th time. There's a story here. There's emotion here. And it's a great adventure to go on. And it really reaches back to, considering Steven Spielberg is remains an executive producer, although I'm doubtful how much involvement he had on a daily basis. It reaches back to that era, which I think is something that the first Transformers movie like kind of brushed, but really wasn't terribly interested in doing because it had to get to the next fight scene. So it makes me sad in that regard. I also want to just mention John Cena is the army guy in it, because you have to have an army guy. But they allowed John Cena to be funny, which plays to his strength, that he's a tough guy that has genuine comedy chops. I think the shame of it is that we don't, because clearly Hasbro's in, who owns the Transformers, is in a game to sort of build their own expanded universe. They have an actual name for their production company now that I noticed. Instead of just saying Hasbro at the beginning, it says Allspark Productions, which is a Transformers doodad. Be that as it may, I'm disappointed in a number of ways. Number one is this could be the last Transformers movie we see for a while, and this would be an excellent place from which to rebuild. I'm not sure that's going to be possible. The other thing is that you have John Cena in it, and there's obviously sort of something in there that makes you sort of think maybe there's another Hasbro thing that John Cena can lead. Tough guy, blonde hair, military uniform. It just would have been interesting at the end if someone says, we hear your call sign is Duke, so we're going to requisition you to a new unit, and then we could launch G.I. Joe with John Cena as the lead of G.I. Joe. I don't want to get too much into the engineering of expanded universes, though. I'm just happy we had a decent Transformers movie for a change. Let me say, better than decent. So that leaves like a good place to take a break on. And we're going to take that break, and then we're going to come back with more reviews. Talking by yourself for an hour is hard. I just want to put that out there. But we're doing it. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Some people like to dive right in. Can you imagine that? And flap about in bathtub gin. Can you imagine that? Doggies paddling 20 leagues below might seem real, but we know it's not so. To cook without a recipe, can you imagine that? And heaven knows what lives within that pot. Some pirates follow treasure maps and wear a silly hat. They search the world for buried gold. They won't grow up and don't grow old. Can you imagine that?
I want you to be my VP. You're the solution to my problem.
I'm CEO of a large company. I have been Secretary of Defense. I have been Chief of Staff. The Vice Presidency is mostly a symbolic job.
Right, right. I can see how that wouldn't be enticing to you.
However, the vice presidency is also defined by the president. And if we were to come to a different understanding.
Uh-huh. Go on. I'm listening.
I sense that you're a kinetic leader. You make decisions based on instinct.
I am. People always said that.
Yeah, yeah. Very different. Very different from your father in that regard. Now, maybe I can handle some of the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, managing military, energy, foreign policy.
Well, That sounds good.
And that's a clip from Vice. It is the new film from Adam McKay, and it stars Christian Bale, Amy Adams, Steve Carell, and Sam Rockwell. I was trying to figure out who the other guy there in that conversation was. You can tell it's live. But we're going to talk about more about Vice in a second. Before we played that clip from Vice, that was a song from Mary Poppins Returns. And I think, since I have no particularly evident songwriting skills, I'll just say it's one of the better songs, or at least one of the more memorable songs from Mary Poppins Returns, which I think is like the biggest default about Mary Poppins Returns is that the songs aren't that memorable. You can think of a handful from the original 64 Mary Poppins, you know, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, the Kick Your Knees Up Step in Time one. I can't remember what that exactly one is called, Spoonful of Sugar. Of course, that's the Sherman Brothers, who are very well-known songwriters who also did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. They did Bedknobs and Broomsticks. They did almost the entire thing for The Jungle Book. They did the Winnie the Pooh movie. They also wrote It's a Small World After All, which I think is the most profitable song that has ever been done. If you've ever been to a Disney theme park, it's on a loop. when you're up against that, when you're up against the Sherman Brothers, it's sort of hard to catch that lightning in a bottle. But I think it's also Mary Poppins Returns. It's a very enjoyable film, no doubt about it. But it's also very much in keeping with the Disney formula, which is we have all this great IP that means so much to people, whether that is, you know, animated movies of the past like Dumbo or Lion King, which are both being remade for this year. Mary Poppins, Star Wars, Marvel, all the Pixar guys, you know, there's an operation here in Hollywood where one of the last five big studios is almost entirely in the business of digging up the stuff they've done before and cleaning it up, or just wholesale ripping it off and putting it in new packaging. And Mary Poppins doesn't quite break out of that mold, although there is something trying to break free that is trying to set itself apart. And I think one of those things is Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins. She's just completely charming and lovely in the part, and she's great singing too. One of the things I liked, and from what I gather it's more closely related to the way P.L. Travers envisioned the role of Mary Poppins, is that there's kind of a trickster god aspect to Emily Blunt's Mary Poppins, where it's not just like she's going around doing these magical things, but the kids will be like, oh my goodness, Mary Poppins did this magical, like she took us into a trip into the Royal Dalton Ball. And she's like, did I really? Which is kind of fun too, that, you know, she's sort of playing with the perceptions and trying to, you know, get the kids to, you know, sort of come to their own conclusions rather than leading about like some sort of strict governess, which is sort of the way Julie Andrews was playing it. So it is a bit more interesting in that regard. The artistry, of course, is impeccable. There's a whole 2D animated sequence in this. When they go into the Royal Dalton Bowl, that was really well realized. I didn't think Disney still had it in them, or they had the artists on hand who could do a really great 2D animated sequence, but they did. Lin-Manuel Miranda, who very famous for Hamilton. I wish they didn't have him do the Cockney accent, because I don't think he wears it well. I don't know why he couldn't have just talked like Lin-Manuel Miranda. But when they finally like let him loose in an actual song and dance number, it is tremendous. He and Emily Blunt make a good pair, I think, in that regard. And another good pairing in this is Meryl Streep as Cousin Topsy, Mary Poppins' Cousin Topsy. That is, I think, a favorite sequence of mine, too. Just seeing Meryl Streep ham it up in this, and you know, wearing like crayons around her neck because she's a fix it person. She can fix anything, and that scene was really lively and well realized. But again, I can't remember the song from it. I remember, you know, the way Meryl Streep sort of hammed it up. I remember the dancing and the production design in it, but I can't remember the song, and that's kind of infuriating. That you go into a musical and the music is sort of the least memorable part. The other thing that bothered me, and before I move on, I just, you know, the way it is that, or the plot is that it's the grown-up Banks children from the first film. They're adults now, and Michael Banks has his own family. And for some reason, Jane Banks, even though she looks like Emily Mortimer, isn't married, which seems bizarre to me. But the Michael Banks, it's his children. His wife has passed, and you know they're struggling because it's the Great Depression. And in walks Mary Poppins again, and Michael has a line. It's like, Mary Poppins, it's like you haven't changed a bit, and she brushes it off like, well, you never ask a woman about her age. But it kind of pains me that there's nothing in this film that shows Michael Banks doing any kind of like critical examination. That's like, here's this woman who was like my nanny for a week when I was 10. She comes back in randomly, just sort of said she's moving in and she's going to be nanny to my kids. She hasn't looked like she's changed a bit, but okay, we'll just go with it. It seems a bit bizarre that, you know, Michael Banks, supposedly now like a sort of a more worldly man, a more cynical man, just kind of goes with it through the course. But I guess that's why they call it fantasy. Getting a bit more serious, The Favorite, which is Yorgos Lanthimos' new film, it's been said like it's his most accessible film, which I don't think is saying much considering that one of his big breakthrough films, The Lobster, was about a world where if you don't fall in love and find your soulmate, you get turned into an animal. That's kind of a simplistic plot summary, but that's basically what it was about. This film, which he didn't write, by the way, it was an unusual thing for him. It's about the sort of based on a true story, the court of Queen Anne in 18th century England, and some of the royal backbiting. There's a war with France going on. I think it's the Seven Years' War, if I'm not mistaken. But so the war is raging on. It's costing a lot of money, as wars do. There's concern that the people are being asked to give up too much to the war effort. But this is more focused on the inner chambers of Queen Anne. Her friend, Lady Mulberry, who is also her lover. There's a relationship there that sort of gets tested when in arrives a new person who ends up being Lady Mulberry's cousin, and she's played by Emma Stone. What I found interesting about The Favorite is that when Emma Stone comes in, because of her position, because of what's going on with her, and because, frankly, Emma Stone is not unfamiliar in playing the role of the ingenue, you immediately sort of find your sympathies going to her and not so much to Lady Mulberry, who's played by Rachel Weisz, who's very, you know, very much of the upper class mold, very staid, very, you know, very uptight. And, you know, you feel less sympathetic towards her. And it's amazing watching these sympathies shift over the course of the film as Emma Stone's character becomes more sort of status-seeking and more social climbing, and as Rachel Weisz's character sort of loses everything maybe she took for granted slip away from her. So those character dynamics are interesting, but it's all wrapped up in this tart script that has so many great lines that involves people just being so vicious to one another, and being able to cut each other down with you know, just a well-placed barb. It's fascinating because you're never sure where it's going. And at times you're not even entirely sure who the heroes are or what the stakes are. It's just this like sort of chamber drama that, you know, could almost work as a stage play too. But the camera work in this is so interesting. And there's so many of these wide sweeping shots of the hallway and the corridors as you're following people down the hallways. And there's this like one scene where you see Emma Stone pushed the Queen, who's played by Olivia Colman, as I said at the top, who won the Golden Globe. But she's pushing the Queen down the hallways, and there's this like kind of like fisheye lens over the camera where it's sort of bending the hallway, so you see the wheelchair being pushed across the screen in this kind of like V shape. It lends to a sort of air of I guess voyeurism of a sort watching this happen. So there's a lot of interesting camera work too, and the setting is marvelous. It takes place on this estate. I'm not sure exactly where, but it looks sort of like it was plucked out of time. It's surrounded by all these great woods that seem to be untouched by the modern world, or at least that's the way the movie makes it appear. So everything in this movie is fire and great, but it wouldn't work at all if it weren't for the three central performances: Olivia Colman, Rachel Weisz, and Emma Stone. Olivia Colman is so great. You know, watching someone, she's clearly struggling with depression, probably dementia. Just sort of being put through the emotional wringer too by sort of everyone in her life to watch her struggle. It's hard not to feel sympathetic, even though it's this sort of regal figure. I'll say Nicholas Hoult too, who plays the leader of the opposition. He's also very good. And the movie plays well into the whole absurdity of sort of the first estate in the 18th century. The powdered wigs and the leggings and the pageantry, let's say. It there's always sort of a cynical tongue in the way, or a cynical eye, I should say, in the way that Yorgos Lanthimos is sort of framing all this. It's like, can you believe people used to do this stuff? That people used to dress like this? That people used to take part in these activities? And there's a dance scene where I've never seen that type of dancing before. I'm not a ballroom dancing expert at all, but I wonder if it was like a real dance, or if it was like something that a choreographer cooked up to make it look like this is like some kind of ridiculous dance that might have been done back in the day. It's an interesting question that I would put to Yorgos Lanthimos if I ever had an opportunity to talk to him, because I couldn't find any insight into that. Anyway, speaking of royal courts, the last film I'm going to talk about is Vice, and it's directed by Adam McKay, who of course did The Big Short a few years ago, and if you are familiar with his other recent show on HBO, Succession, in which it's about, I think it's ostensibly based on the Murdoch Empire, Rupert Murdoch and his sons. But in tackling the life and times of Dick Cheney, Adam McKay again does, I think, something he's very talented at, which is to take thoroughly unlikable characters and make you root for them. And I think that's what we see here with Dick Cheney, Dick Cheney's life story. And it's an incredible two hours and 10 minutes. Dick Cheney's political life goes back to before or around the time Nixon became president, so like the late 60s, and so we're talking about like a 30-year period, rather skillfully condensed to sort of show all those sort of these big moments, like when he and Rumsfeld found themselves in the inner circle of the Nixon administration, working for Gerald Ford after that, and then you know, coming in and working for Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. And then, of course, the big one, which is how he becomes vice president to George W. Bush. I wonder
if Adam McKay is giving too much credit to Dick Cheney for being sort of like the root of all evil in the world in terms of where we are right now. I think there are a lot of people who own a piece of that, and I don't think Dick Cheney certainly didn't help, but I don't think it all falls on Dick Cheney. I think Dick Cheney, at least in terms of how the film partially portrays him too, was always opportunistic. I don't think he was terribly concerned about what his legacy was going to be. There's a quote at the beginning of the film where, I can't remember it all, but it's like, when people talk, the quiet man listens. When people act, the quiet man plans. And when they are tired, he strikes. So I think that neatly sums up Dick Cheney's political life. What's fascinating, too, is that, you know, he kind of starts off as like a similar George W. Bush figure. He's like, he drank his way to failing out of Ivy League, and he seemed to show no initiative at all. And it sort of fell to Lynn Cheney to sort of slap him into pursuing a career of, well, I won't say excellence, but let's say a career of accomplishment. I do want to toast Amy Adams for playing Lynn Cheney, because I can't remember a time I found Amy Adams so utterly unlikable. And it's not like she doesn't have range. Amy Adams has incredible range, but to just to play someone so hideous as Lynn Cheney and to do it so well, she did a good job. Steve Carell, I think, though, is the real star. I mean, a lot of people make, you know, correctly talk about Christian Bale's, you know, perhaps over dedication to the method by, you know, packing on the pounds. But I think the real star, or at least star role, is serious dramatic actor Steve Carell. I think he gets this mixture of charm and malice that Donald Rumsfeld has. If you've seen the, what's his name? Anyway, the movie about Donald Rumsfeld, the unknown known, Morrison. Yeah, he did that one. You sort of see that effect of Donald Rumsfeld, that he's this oily guy that you kind of can't help but like, that he's kind of got this, not necessarily folksy, but an accessible charm about him, even though he's maybe one of the most ostensibly evil people ever to be in politics. But you come to appreciate that, and you sort of see what maybe Dick Cheney saw. I mean, again, this is a film about horrendously unlikable people who did horrendously horrible things, but you can't help but like them, which is weird. But I give full kudos to Adam McKay for that. I wonder if Vice sort of dives too deep in sort of to the metatextualism. Adam McKay did that a lot, like a lot of breaking the fourth wall in The Big Short, which worked fairly well because you're dealing with this complicated machine in The Big Short, all these financial technobabble of, you know, what's a subprime mortgage and what's a trunk and so on and so forth. This is kind of a more of a straightforward biopic, so I'm not sure how effective it is here. When you the clip I played earlier is of you can't see it obviously because it's we're in an audio medium, but in it there's, it's overlaid of scenes of George W. Bush talking to Dick Cheney, overseen of scenes of Dick Cheney fly fishing, and there's a scene where George W. Bush is taking a bite out of a chicken wing, and the way it looks, the screen pauses, and the way it looks is that he's got his mouth open, the chicken wing is like just off to the side of his mouth, so it looks like he's been caught on a fly fishing lure, and it's like, I understand what you're doing, Adam McKay. I don't need it sort of, you know, I don't need you to draw the dots for me. That's fine. I think the film goes a little too far in that regard. And speaking of George W. Bush, I think that the film leads a little too far into the dumb Bush trope. the idea that he was sort of a puppet of Dick Cheney, I don't think that's true. I like a lot, and I talked about this several years ago on one of the political movie show we did for Open Sources, but the Oliver Stone W movie, I think that is a better portrayal, not just because I think it was also a better performance, Josh Brolin as George W. Bush, Sam Rockwell's a fine actor, but I don't think he was really called to do much here, which is too bad. But yeah, it leans a bit too much on dumb Bush, but I think the movie all around, I think it's definitely a film worth seeing. I think it adds to the picture of sort of where we are today politically. I think to understand where you are, you also have to understand the political life of Dick Cheney, for sure. And the film does that in a good way. It's got humor, it's got pathos, it plays with your perceptions a little, but it is rewarding in that I think it makes no apologies for Dick Cheney. And you can sort of see how Oliver Stone was maybe trying to make apologies for George W. Bush. He may argue with that intent, but you can sort of see it there. I don't think Adam McKay is making any apologies for Dick Cheney, and certainly Dick Cheney probably wouldn't want any apologies made on his behalf. But it is, I think, a thoroughly entertaining and accessible movie that sort of informs of, you know, why we are here in this political life in the year 2019 now. And then we're going to call that a wrap for this hour of end credits, our first new show for 2019. Although I guess technically last week was our first show of 2019, but we recorded it in 2018. So whatever. I'm going to wrap it up and say thanks for listening. And we're going to do a rerun show next week. We're going to put a couple of pieces together and a remix. Let's call it a remix. That's what we're going to do next week. And then we'll be back with a brand new episode the week after that. And we'll have more. We'll keep you posted on the website and on the social medias for any and all details in that regard. So You can find our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, End Credits Radio on the Twitter sphere. I will be back here tomorrow at 5 p.m. for Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. That's news and politics. And in the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will, of course, be back here in some form next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. And we'll see you then.